ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And a very good afternoon. Selena Green here for another edition of The Country Hour. What do you make of the federal government's proposed biosecurity protection levy? Well, the Senate inquiry into the levy starts its hearings today. You'll hear from a South Australian who's made a number of submissions to this inquiry shortly, but I'd like to hear from you also today. What's your stance on the levy? Are you happy to pay it? Do you see it as another tax on primary producers? Do you think there's a better way to fund biosecurity here in Australia? My talkback number is 1300 222 891, or send me your thoughts on the text line, which is 0467 922 891. Also coming up, a record amount of lamb is heading east out of Western Australia. What does it say about the industry?
First 2 months of 2024, we had as many transferred west to east in that first 2 months as what we saw the whole of 2023. That tells me how dry it is and how much the West Australian sector, and particularly sheep producer there, is suffering.
A closer look coming up in this half an hour as well. But first today, there's been a groundswell of opposition from primary producers to a new biosecurity protection levy being proposed by the federal government. And today, a number of farming and industry groups have been given a chance to voice their concerns. A Senate Standing Committee is holding an inquiry into the proposed levy laws, and it's holding its first public hearing today in Canberra. Well, South Australian-based Trevor Ranford was the winner of a 2022 Australian Government Biosecurity Award and made submissions to the inquiry as an individual, but also on behalf of Australia's summer fruit and nut industries. I spoke with him earlier. He said their opposition began the day the levy was announced.
The whole process really has put industry offside with the minister, the government and the department. And at a time when we need people working together, this proposal is just dividing what is supposed to be a shared responsibility for biosecurity.
So what do you see as the greatest flaws in the proposed levy? Is it simply the fact of producers being asked to pay more? Is it the way that the levy will be implemented? What is it that is your particular opposition?
Yeah, from day one, it's the actual imposition of a tax, and that's nothing more than a tax on businesses. You know, the 85,000 primary producers in Australia. And ultimately it's a tax on the produce that growers produce. So you know, that's really where it starts and ends. The reality is that all of the industries I work for, and while you indicated I put one in for summer fruit, I also helped develop responses for chestnuts, hazelnuts and walnuts. And it's the same situation. Industry and growers have been paying more than their fair share for a long period of time on biosecurity, and the risk creators have been missing in action as far as their contribution to this shared responsibility of biosecurity.
And by that, do you mean those importers? I know there has been lots of talk around a container levy as well. Is that where you see the missing sort of piece as far as contributions go?
Well, it's in those areas where the container levy is the appropriate action. But I'll give you an example where there are three incidents of capra beetle coming into Australia. They came in. One was in a container of high chairs. Another incident was a container of fridges. Another incident was a container of nappies. Yet it was agricultural and horticultural industries, grains, walnuts, pistachios, who are paying the cost-sharing process of those three incidents. You know, they weren't responsible for the particular pest coming into Australia, yet under the, you know, what I think is a flawed structure at the present moment, the growers were forced to pay a percentage share of that particular incident. So it's not getting to the risk creators in the whole process.
As you mentioned, you've put forward a few submissions on behalf of a number of industries, but just looking at the one for Summer Fruit Australia, you mentioned that the industry has been doing heavy lifting for decades in relation to funding the biosecurity system, not all of that necessarily financial, some of that in kind. Can you just elaborate on how you see, you know, an industry like Summer Fruits already contributing greatly to biosecurity?
First of all, it's a member of Plant Health Australia, so it pays its annual membership to that organisation, and that organisation is a tripartite group where the federal government, the state and territory agencies and the industry are equal partners in the process, and through that they manage the emergency plant pest response deed. The industry signed that deed decades ago and has been an active participant in a whole range of different incidents, more recently varroa mite, and the growers will be required to pay their share of the cost recovery of that particular incident. And, for Summer Fruit, it will represent potentially, $200,000. It's involved with the exotic fruit fly incident or program. It will, as part of the cost-sharing process, be putting in another $50,000. So every incident comes along, the growers are forced to contribute in that process. Over and above that, I represent the industry at Plant Health Australia, at biosecurity roundtables, representing industry on what's called the Consultative Committee for Emergency Plant Pests and the National Management Group. And, with varroa mite, there have been 20 or 30 of those particular meetings over the last 18 months or so, or nearly 2 years now, and they're all being funded out of industry and grower contributions.
So if the answer is not another levy, Trevor, what do you see? And given that, we are facing increasing and new threats to agriculture here in Australia every day, are there, if not a levy, what do you see as the answer? Does it need to go back to the drawing board, how biosecurity is funded and how that is shared across the country?
Oh, most definitely. I think, in all of the submissions that we put forward, to me or to us, there's a simple solution at this point in time, and that is to drop the tax component and establish a high-level working group of government and industry to actually, review the biosecurity situation, look at the model, and develop an appropriate funding process. And quite frankly, industry's been calling for that sort of high level of involvement for a good many years. And if the minister had taken that on board as an initial step and involved industry in a true partnership situation of reviewing biosecurity and the current model, we wouldn't be at this unfortunate situation of a them and us aspect. And as you would see, there are, 58 responses to the Senate inquiry. There was a letter penned months ago and signed by 50 primary producing industries calling on the government and the minister to put a hold on this process and come back to the table to really work on practical solutions. And again, the figures put forward just don't include what industry is already contributing and also what governments are already contributing from the point of view of managing the many incidents, particularly in the plant world, that we continue to face. So let's step back and take a fresh look at the whole process, because the reality is we're getting more and more incidents of exotic pests and diseases. So somewhere along the line, the system is not fully working, and we need to fix that and then work towards the appropriate methods of funding the program.
That is horticultural industry advocate and the CEO of Summerfruit Australia, Trevor Ranford, speaking there. On the text line, a text that comes through simply says, levy too late to stop fire ants, carp, etc., etc. Keep your thoughts coming through. It's just going on 15 minutes past 12. Well, a bit of an update for you into investigations into the deaths of around 150 Northern Territory cattle. And those investigations suggest the likely cause was a parasitic disease known as coccidiosis. When around 100 cattle started showing signs of illness while on board the Brahm Express bound for Indonesia last month, a similar event was unfolding at an export depot near Darwin, where about 50 cattle died. The cattle all originated from the one station in Central Australia. The Northern Territory government investigated the deaths at the export depot, while the federal government, Department of Agriculture, investigated the deaths on board the express vessel. In a statement to ABC Rural, a department spokesperson said coccidiosis has been identified as a potential cause of the deaths. However, a definitive diagnosis has not yet been reached. If you want to read more about this, there's an online story with more detail now on abc.net.au/rural.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, a record amount of lamb is travelling from drought-stricken areas of Western Australia to the East Coast, to farms with feed or to processors with capacity. It's a long drive and a costly exercise for WA farmers to sell the lambs to the East Coast, but it highlights the difficult conditions that farmers there are facing and the lack of markets they can sell into. Matt Dalgleish from Episode 3 says more lamb has been driven east in 2024 so far than the entirety of last year.
We're actually seeing some strong flows as of the start of 2024. So first 2 months of 2024, we had as many transferred west to east in that first 2 months as what we saw the whole of 2023.
Wow, so all last year, all the numbers of sheep that came from Western Australia across to the eastern states in 2023, you've already hit that number in the first 2 months of this
year. Correct. And we've just seen the March numbers release today, and there's another 120,000 odd that came across in March. So it was about 200 and it would have been just a bit over 220,000 for the first 2 months, and now we've had another 120 on that. So it's going to be a strong year for those transfers if these numbers keep kind of continuing through the year.
What does that tell you as an analyst?
Well, A, that there's a discount in price that can make it worthwhile to send that many, because, you know, normally you don't see anywhere near those flows west to east every single year. That tells me how dry it is and how much the West Australian sector and particularly sheep producer there is suffering. I just saw on Twitter this morning a farmer's digging a pit to shoot animals because he can't sell them, no buyer. And I think that's the story there. It's a very different picture in the west to the east.
Does that show that there's not enough killing capacity in Western Australia to take these excess animals?
Yeah, in terms of capacity to process there, but also as part of that too would be, you know, any alternative market. So it could be domestic processing and kind of value adding completely, or it could be the bag market, which I think you spoke about last week as well, that Middle Eastern kill market, or where it's a whole carcass. So we're not doing as much value add here, but the animals are still being slaughtered here and then shipped usually to the Middle East fairly quickly. That's one of the big hurdles that we've got to get over if we're going to move away from LiveX.
How expensive is it to get lambs from west to east? I can't imagine it's a cheap process.
You've got to have the cost factor there in terms of the discount to make it worth your while. Now, it does depend on the size of the animal. So if you're talking a 55-kilo sheep, so a heavier sheep, you have less on the transport because of the size of that. So that you're talking about $50 a head to get them across the Nullarbor. And if you're talking a lighter lamb, like 35-kilo, because you can get more of them on, it reduces the per-head cost. So they're about a $45 charge to get them across.
That's expensive when you're looking at that per head. That must mean significant discounts to Western Australians.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We see when that discount widens enough in WA, so that you can cover the cost of transport, plus potentially have a little bit of extra just in case for, you know, for anything unforeseen, or, you know, when you're organising the transport, the margin's there, but when you go to do it, you know, the prices change a bit. So you've got to allow for some of that as well, a bit of slippage. But yeah, that's the key driver, is that discount widening enough to make it worthwhile to do the transport.
Prices have been fluctuating, I think it's fair to say, even on the East Coast. Does the influx of WA sheep and lambs affect the prices here?
Yeah, even with those volumes into the hundreds of thousands, we're not talking, you know, significant enough volumes to flood markets here. You probably could see that there's some level of discounting, but you're probably talking cents in the kilo rather than large amounts. And to see the really strong flows like we saw in 2020, when it was that whole year it was 1.9 million head, that's significant flows. But you got to have not just a price discount, you've also got to have really strong demand and restocker demand, which we're not really seeing that in the east now. We saw the lack of confidence in the market last year and how, you know, that flooded our market a bit and the price responded accordingly. This year we've seen a pickup in confidence, but we're not restocking strongly in that sheep flock. So, the demand has to be there just underlying as well as the discount.
Live export isn't banned yet. Why hasn't live export then just taken up these extra numbers of sheep being offloaded in WA?
It isn't banned yet, you're right, but we do have pretty much 4 months of the year where it's not operational in the Northern Hemisphere summer, and we're just about to hit that. You know, mid-May, is when that shuts down effectively, and then it doesn't open again until about mid-September. So that's going to be another added issue for the West Australian producer. That's one market then that won't be there for that part of the year. So that's been problematic, and we have seen historically since 2018 when that moratorium began over the summer, the Northern Hemisphere summer, we know that the discount widens through that period of time. Almost every year we've seen that. The only year we didn't was the year when we had the 1.9 million come across to the east, when New South Wales was in a real strong rebuild phase.
Matt Dalglish is with you. So let's talk about the other issue with the Middle East trade over the last couple of weeks. We saw the initial phase, which sort of has cooled since, but is still there, between Iran launching weapons against Israel, grounding flights, and effectively grounded the bag lamb trade, which is carcasses flying to the Middle East. And we saw immediate price discounts at Victorian sale yards. Is that the kind of thing that will have the lamb industry on edge for a little bit of time?
It will, and it had a bit of an impact too, because capacity was already tight for that air freight market. If you look back to before COVID, the average kind of per tonnage that was going out on Australian planes a day to the Middle East predominantly in a bag market sense was about 160 tonne, and nowadays it's around the 60 tonne, so it's significantly reduced. And then if you overlay then some cancelled flights into that destination because of safety concerns, then that just made that availability shrink even more, and it is really hard to get space on that for carcass.
So it's really hard to get space. Is that just because there's a limited amount of flights going that way from Australia?
Correct, yep, absolutely. And obviously through COVID, you know, when we had less passenger transport, we had to actually organise a few dedicated freight ones to send them as a dedicated shipment, whereas, you know, most of the time they'll piggyback on the passenger flights. And we've had, you know, reduced passenger transport. The numbers have come back now that all the borders are open again, but there are other things, factors like increased efficiency in the airlines. We're now having flights that can go direct from Perth or Darwin straight into London. They don't need to do a stopover in Abu Dhabi, and that just means that we're really reliant on the trips that are coming from the Middle East to Australia and then returning back again, because if we've got regular trips coming, we can piggyback on those passenger trips with carcass in the bottom of the plane.
So something I didn't think of in terms of our trade, but it was a major political issue, was denying the extra flights from Qatar Airways into Australia to allow more passenger services going from those airways. It was seen as a way for the government to protect the Qantas business model. But if those extra flights were there, would that mean more room for lamb to go to the Middle East?
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, if you look at what some of the government strategy is around phase out of live export, it's not the only solution, but one part of the solution, and certainly a very quick short-term solution, particularly for the West Australian market, because they're type of lamb is very well suited to that bag market in terms of lighter carcass. That requires multiple different ways to get that product, and one of those ways is air freight. And if you're reducing or not allowing extra flights to come in, you're kind of stopping the industry from pivoting to a different option other than Live X. You know, you've got to have, you know, the bag market option. You've got to have more processing domestically, so then we can cut it up and send it to other destinations as well as outside the Middle East. You've got to have all these multiple pronged approach if you're going to phase out a whole part of the sector.
That's Matt Dalgliesh there from episode 3, and he was speaking to Warwick Long.
Hi, Waleed Ali here. If your brain's hungry for insights, the ABC Listen app has a feast of podcasts.
Try The Minefield.
Today we're going for the problem of evil.
Injustice and evil, if they're the same thing.
You might also like Future Tense.
And there is a sense of privilege in that idea of natural, isn't there? Which can easily be manipulated.
Without a doubt.
Or Dr. Carl.
You can feel a slight cooling, that's latent heat of vaporisation or something.
Load up a podcast and feed your mind with the ABC Listen app.
It was Selena Green on the South Australian Country Hour. It's 24 minutes past 12. Let's head to the Weather Bureau. Dominic Panuccio is again our forecaster today. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Selena.
Do we see another very fresh start across many parts of South Australia this morning?
Yeah, it was not quite as cold as yesterday morning, actually, for a lot of the state. Actually, quite a bit milder in some areas. For example, Adelaide had a low of 14 as opposed to yesterday's 6 degrees, so a big difference that those 24 hours made. But, yeah, in some other parts of the state, it was quite cold still, and the coldest place for the state was Kingscote, which dropped to 2.7 degrees. And a few places, particularly in the southeast, also dipped below the 5-degree mark. So it was a bit of a cold start for some areas, but a lot milder in other areas. And today we've got a change moving in. So it's relatively windy for a lot of the state today as that cooler change makes its way across the state from the west. So we've seen those northwesterly winds increase as the front approaches with a cooler, gusty south to southwesterly wind pushing in behind the front. Those southwesterly winds have now arrived across the West Coast District and the Lower Eyre Peninsula District, as well as Kangaroo Island and the far south of York Peninsula. And we're seeing some fairly gusty winds already in that south-southwesterly and in some locations. The change will continue to progress north and eastwards this afternoon, reaching Adelaide and the northern York Peninsula by mid-afternoon, and then making its way across to Mount Gambier and the remaining southeastern districts in the late afternoon before progressing further northwards to the Riverland early this evening and then eventually reaching Cooper Pedy and Lee Creek in the late evening. We're not seeing too much in the way of showers yet. There are a couple of light showers potentially around the far west coast at the moment, but we are expecting a few more light showers to develop following the change over the southern agricultural areas late in the day today and overnight tonight. But remaining dry elsewhere, probably the lower southeast is where we'd see any sort of decent rainfall totals, you know, of around 5 millimetres or so there, but probably less than a millimetre or so elsewhere. So not a lot in it rainfall-wise, but it is a significant temperature drop eventually behind this change. And any showers around should mostly clear early tomorrow morning, but tomorrow will be a much cooler day with top temperatures around 15 to 19 degrees across the agricultural areas. Still getting into the low 20s across the pastoral districts and as much as the mid-20s for the far northeast of the state. Then heading into Thursday, we might see a return of some isolated light shower activity, mainly during the day about the southern agricultural areas and mainly about those windward coasts and ranges in a southerly flow. It's looking like another cold start for many locations on Thursday, dropping to around 5 degrees for both Renmark and Roseworthy, 4 degrees at Clare, and 5 also at the Juna. So quite cold again for many locations on Thursday morning. On Friday, we might continue to see some of those isolated light showers about the windward coast and ranges once again for the southern agricultural areas, but remaining dry elsewhere once again. And similar temperatures. The weekend at this stage is looking mostly dry, but more cold mornings to come. Particularly Saturday morning, it's looking likely we'll see areas of frost across much of the agricultural areas for Saturday morning. So quite a cold one again for Saturday. Remaining cool during the days as well through to Saturday, but it is looking a little bit warmer by Sunday with most maximum temperatures reaching the mid-20s for Sunday. And in terms of the cumulative rainfall totals through to the end of this week, generally less than 2 millimetres for the western coast and the southern agricultural area, but some local falls of around 2 to 8 millimetres possible about the windward coasts and ranges, with the lower southeast being the most likely district to see some falls towards the upper end of that rainfall range, Selena.
All right, thanks for that, Dominic. Dominic Panuccio there from the Weather Bureau. Looking now at the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, the Upper Western District looking at a partly cloudy day. Wind southerlies 25 to 35 k's now, with overnight temperatures falling between 12 and 15 degrees, with daytime temperatures reaching 22 to 29 degrees. For the Lower Western District, a mostly sunny day with southerly winds 20 to 30 k's now, with overnight temperatures falling to between 7 and 12, with daytime temperatures in the low 20s. Coming up in this next half an hour, we'll take a deep dive into the challenges facing Australia's veterinary industry, particularly in rural areas. What are the big challenges? How are we going to overcome them?
Listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Good afternoon. Great to have your company. Now, do you think of your animals, your pets, as part of your family? Well, many do. And so when they're sick, you want to have the best level of health care for them. That, of course, comes at a cost. And while costs have increased, so have our expectations of that level of care. Our veterinary nursing conference in Adelaide has heard that this is putting huge pressure on those working in the industry, which needs more staff and more support, especially in rural areas. Let's take a look at that in a moment. Also, speaking of pets as part of your family, I'll bring you a bit of a sad update and a tribute on a much-loved member of the ABC South Australian Rural Team, Barley, the would-be guide dog.
I said, hey, how do you feel about having a dog come into the office every day and an unofficial ABC Rural dog? And blew me away. He said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Let's make it happen. I approached the RSB that afternoon and said, this is what we'd like to do. And then it just went on from there.
Yeah, I'll bring you that after headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, South Australia has recorded the biggest drop in power prices in the nation, according to a new report by the Australian Energy Market Operator. The report released today shows that the state's wholesale electricity price is 24% lower than the average for quarter one in 2023. The report follows last month's announcement of cuts to the benchmark retail price, the default market offer, which are driven by wholesale price drops. The state government will introduce a bill to Parliament next week to try to strengthen penalties which can be imposed against the state's only casino licence holder, Sky City Adelaide. The proposed laws would increase potential fines faced for misconduct from the current maximum of $100,000 to up to $75 million. It comes as the regulator AUSTRAC commenced federal court proceedings against the casino over allegations of breaking anti-money laundering laws. And in cricket, after 8 seasons with the Adelaide Strikers, fast bowler Wes Agar has been traded to Sydney Thunder in the Big Bash League. Agar took 69 wickets in 56 matches for Adelaide and earned the club's MVP award in 2021 after taking 22 wickets for the season. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman there with that news update.
ABC Radio, emergency information.
Just advising that there has been a watch and act for a bushfire that is burning at Malinong, which is around 18 kilometres northeast of Meningie in the Coorong. So we've been advised that that bushfire is burning now. The CFS does advise for those in that area to leave now, as this bushfire may threaten your safety. Check that the path is clear and go to a safer place. Do not enter this area as conditions are dangerous. So the Malinong bushfire, 18 kilometres northeast of Meningie in the Coorong, it's uncontrolled. We're told this stubble fire is burning in a northwesterly direction towards Bagshaw Road and Malinong Road, and those conditions are continually changing. Keep tuned to ABC Radio for any further updates, and you can also keep across that on the CFS website as well. So that is a watch and act for a bushfire burning at Malinong, which is around 18 kilometres northeast of Meningie in the Coorong. It is 24 minutes to one. Now, if you have animals, do you consider them part of your family? Well, our animals, whether they're pets or livestock, because they mean a lot to us, so understandably, when they're sick or injured, we want the best veterinary care for them. But this is putting, well, huge pressure on Australia's veterinary industry, which says it doesn't have the same level of resources or support to give our animals the same level of health care we expect for humans. And that, all combined with cost of living pressures, having detrimental impacts on those who are working in clinics across the country. So what can be done? Well, Erica Honey is a consultant and a veterinary nurse with more than 20 years' experience in the industry. She was in Adelaide for last week's Veterinary Nurses Council of Australia conference, where she presented on a session titled, The Veterinary Industry, Can We Fix It? Yes, we can. Erica, thanks for joining me on the Country Hour.
Well, thank you for having me.
So before we talk about fixing the veterinary industry, is it fair to describe it as broken at the moment?
Yeah. I think it is fair to say that it's structurally broken. We really do need a lot more support for the industry. And if you were to ask me what's the main thing, I think, you know, structurally it's that lack of Commonwealth systems and support for veterinary hospitals and our teams, but also our clients and their animals as well. So we've really been dealing with a lot of the same issues for decades, but it's that pandemic that really brought the struggles to light. And so one of the big things around this is that societal expectations of how we care for animals has increased, and that's along with those expectations of veterinary care. So the expectations are on par with human medicine, essentially. And the other thing is that our animals are often considered as members of the family. So, again, you know, a lot of care needed there, and people have that high expectation. But then there's also other animals such as wildlife that vet practices and people are actually funding themselves. So there's very limited funding out there for veterinary practices, you know, working in that area. So if we quickly have a look at healthcare, and it's an important area to compare because of the level of medicine veterinary teams are practicing. So if we look at healthcare, they've got a variety of departments and commissions that are funding medical professionals and also their allied health areas. Veterinary, on the other hand, has minimal support for our patient loads. So our industry is actually worth billions. $5.3 billion from 2023 were the findings. But then the associated industry of pet care, $30.7 billion. So that's quite a lot. And we need, obviously, those vet teams for healthy pets. And just quickly, if we look at the data, this is 2021-2022, we have about 125,000 human doctors to look after around 26 million Australians. 2024 data states we've got around 303,000 registered nurses, plus enrolled nurses and midwives. But then if you look at the patient load for veterinary, we've got 30.4 million pets cared for by only 13,500 vets approximately, and then 12,600 veterinary nurses. And as I said, that care that our owners or pet guardians are expecting is often on par with that human level. And we can provide that. We've got a variety of specialties to deliver it.
And as you get further out from the cities, as we see with human health services, does it become more acute as you get more regionally into more rural areas as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it mirrors those kinds of issues. But in some instances, it's worse because there isn't actually those resources and support mechanisms for veterinary teams. So one of my very good friends is a vet, and she has very happily moved to the country. They're very lucky to have her as well. But that's because she wanted to go. Whereas you look at one of my other friends who's a doctor, she's moved up to Karratha. The funding and the support that their family got to move just so that they could have another doctor up there doing the emergency work is phenomenal. So you can see the disparity between the two areas. So I also think back to my hometown, and we haven't actually had a vet there in that Wheatbelt area for about maybe 3-4 years approximately. So this means that anyone in that area and surrounds actually have to travel. And luckily, we actually have a great veterinary team about 1.5 hours away. But that's all fine for people who've got cars and can actually get there. The access is obviously reduced for, you know, the everyday people who are struggling and may not be able to afford the petrol. And, of course, that time away from work as well to travel to get to a vet. So So interestingly, the after-hours care in the country can also be the issue as well. So obviously we've got these big geographic areas in Australia, the biggest one obviously in WA, but we're seeing these issues around Australia. So our vet teams obviously can't work 24/7 with no rest, and they need that downtime. So in the city, my background's in emergencies, so in the city it's not uncommon for us to get a call at 2 a.m. in the morning from someone in the country. Now, in WA, it's quite common for me to say to someone, I'm sorry, you're going to need to get into the car and drive 4 hours to your closest vet or you could potentially lose your animal. So this is, as I said, happening around Australia, and this is actually this workforce shortage and lack of resources is what actually sparked the New South Wales parliamentary inquiry in 2023, and I understand that those findings will be released soon.
I'm speaking to consultant and veterinary nurse Erica Honey today. She's been speaking in Adelaide at a national veterinary nurse conference. So, Erica, we've heard so much about the pressures and stresses that those in the industry are under. What are your concerns if the status quo remains and things don't change?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's numerous concerns for our veterinary industry. You know, the number one's probably workforce shortages, and that's just one of the biggest things we're seeing. So shortage of all of the veterinary professionals, so veterinary nurses, technicians and veterinarians. And what we're finding is that they're having to restrict caseload to be able to manage what's actually happening. So they may even close for a day or a night or even a weekend. They're not accepting new clients, but what's actually going on behind the scenes is they're trying to manage the caseload that they've got. Then what happens is those patients will go to other veterinary hospitals if they're in the city or in the country they'll travel. And then, as you can see, that puts pressure on other veterinary practices as well. So they're trying to balance them all and really playing, you know, a juggling act with that patient load. And, of course, they're trying to do the best they can. They triage these cases, but this is the situation that they're in. And, of course, we have to look after our people. One of the other concerns is the inability to charge what veterinary medicine is worth. Now, I know this is a very controversial area, but, you know, the pure fact of the measure is vets don't generally drive expensive cars, and many of our veterinary nurses and technicians are on a very low income. So this is not great considering the level of qualifications, skills, knowledge, abilities, and also that responsibility that they shoulder. So there's some legislative responsibilities there as well. And I note that there's no real universal health care for animals other than the veti care that Victoria is about to start soon. So our people, our clients, don't have necessarily the means to pay what medicine's actually worth in terms of vet meds. The next point is the mental health concerns. So certainly one of the bigger issues and a bit of a trigger warning here. I'm sorry to say it, but we have very high rates of death by suicide in our industry. Another trigger warning, I've lost 6 colleagues to it, and that impacts you as a person, it impacts your family, it impacts your whole entire team and the community, thinking about rural communities that are also quite close-knit as well. There's very, very big impact. So studies show, and this is from a few years ago now, we've actually got new data being released soon, but previous studies show that our rate of death by suicide is nearly 4 times the general population. And so obviously that's a huge, huge issue, not just for the veterinary community, but those flow-on effects.
What do you think are some of the keys to addressing some of these issues?
Yeah, so I think structurally more support, and that's at that Commonwealth level and state level. At the moment we've got, you know, Veterinary Nurse Association and the Australian Vet Association. They're doing a great job, but it's not really, if I can say it, their responsibility to shoulder everything. We do actually need that governmental public support in terms of the public area. And so some funding there as well for veterinary care and animal welfare. We've got plenty of new businesses starting in veterinary allied health. There's opportunities for pet ambulance and also urgent care centres, which means that we're able to balance the care in different areas. So starting to look a little bit like human health in that instance. And then there's opportunities for new roles as well. So still a lot of discussion to be had around this, but vet nurse practitioners, this will need some legislative change as well. So there's some slower moving changes that we'll see, but they could really impact us in a good way. So in terms of some programs that are going on, they're certainly not going to replace the need for those structural supports. But we have the new Australian Vet Association Thrive Program for Mental Health, which has got some fantastic initiatives involved in that. We've also got Veterinary and Community Care Group as well. So this is a charity that's actually bringing veterinary social work training programs to Australia. And these veterinary social workers have a unique set of skills where they can actually assist for access for our clients, referral services for our clients. Perhaps they've got other pressures that mean that they're not able to pay for all of their care, for example, and just other things going on, because we're really looking at it from that one health and one welfare perspective. So what happens with animals impacts humans and vice versa. We've also got another group called Sophie's Legacy, and some of our listeners may have heard about them. They do a program called We're Only Human, and this is really a great initiative around demonstrating that our veterinary teams are doing their best and that civility is needed on all accounts, because veterinary teams, unfortunately and sadly, do experience a fair amount of abuse, even though they're doing the best that they can. And that can be about money, it can be about the pressures of life. There's a lot of things going on there.
Sounds like plenty going on, and hopefully some of these will bring about some change. It sounds like it certainly is needed for those, as you say, working very hard in this industry, an important industry. Erica, thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour today. It was great to have your time.
You're welcome. Thank you so much to you and the listeners.
That is consultant and veterinary nurse Erica Honey speaking there. And if this conversation, if this did raise any concerns or issues for you, please do reach out to Lifeline on 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36. Well, speaking of veterinary practices, and the Australian Veterinary Association wants the federal government to provide education fee relief to vets to address workforce shortages in rural and remote areas. The Regional Education Commissioner made the recommendation in its latest report to encourage early career vets to work in rural areas. And AVA President Dr. Diana Barker explains why this is an important solution to the crisis.
The Regional Education Commissioner's annual report, so the Honourable Fiona Nash, has called out that the veterinary workforce is in crisis, and we do have a workforce shortage, especially and particularly in regional and rural Australia. What the report calls for is education fee relief, which will encourage graduate veterinarians to go into rural areas and support the local communities there. This is something the Australian Veterinary Association has been calling on for several years. And additionally, that there should be changes to the funding models of training. So currently, at the moment, we see veterinarians as a requirement of graduating from a veterinary degree, needing to do 52 weeks of unpaid placement. And this requirement really limits vets' ability to go into rural regional vets for that clinical work, mainly because being that it's unpaid, needing to pay for travel costs, needing to pay for accommodation to complete that placement, when it's much easier to sort of stay at home where you're already paying rent or you've already got your part-time job, much easier to go to clinics that are closer to home. So there is a lack of those students going into rural and regional communities. We do see that if students are able to go into those communities, that there is a bit more of an uptake in terms of them going rurally. But this education fee relief will also sort of play a big part in incentivising those graduates to going into those communities, which are crying out for vets.
And you mentioned just before that it's been a problem for some time. When did it start, do you think? Or is it sort of something that's been creeping up for a while now?
Yeah, look, we had a report about 20 years ago foreseeing this to be a problem. But really, I think the COVID-19 pandemic probably compounded it. But it's been happening. It's been happening long before that. Vets have it's hard work being a vet, and particularly in those rural and regional communities where you're required to do out-of-hours care. Often there's not an emergency centre close by, so we are required to provide that care to both pets and livestock, requiring care to be looked after or seen in emergency situations. And for those rural regional vets, they can sometimes be working 24/7, especially if they're a solo practitioner. So it is a hard job. It's relentless. We do know that there, in the veterinary profession, there is a higher mental health. There are higher mental health issues, and we do know that work stress does contribute to it.
That is Australian Veterinary Association President Dr. Diana Barker there speaking with Timu King. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour, and it's 12 minutes to one. Well, finally today, and for long-time ABC listeners who remember Annabelle Homer, who presented the South Australian Country Hour for many years and also the Late Afternoons program, you might remember Belle's sidekick, guide dog in training, Barley. Well, being in training, Barley had to go everywhere with Belle, and this included the ABC office, the studio, and outside broadcast as well. But in some sad news, Barley passed away last week at the age of 13. But Brooke Neindorf caught up with now Annabelle Ottens about the day she decided to take on Barley.
I know, it was a bit random, to be honest, Brooke. I remember I was sitting in the office at the Country Hour. It was the afternoon, and Carol Whitelock was interviewing a bunch of people from the Royal Society for the Blind, and they had all the puppy dogs in the foyer just outside the studio. And I was watching them, and I was listening to the interview that Carol was doing with them about being a puppy educator. I was sitting there, and I was like, I could do that. That sounds like fun. Not really thinking it through. And then I said to Drew Radford, who was the executive producer at the time, I said, hey, how do you feel about having a dog come into the office every day and an unofficial ABC rural dog? And blew me away. He just said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Let's make it happen. And it was like, bang, that afternoon, I approached the RSB that afternoon and said, this is what we'd like to do. And then it just went on from there. So it was just a really random thought. And I think I would not have done it if Drew wasn't on board. So that's how it all started.
And she definitely became a big part of the rural team. Everyone sort of seemed to know Barley, and she was named by the listeners, and she came along to outside broadcasts and got on with everybody. She came to everything. You know, what were some of the adventures that she did go on?
Oh, well, it's funny because I didn't really know what I was getting myself in for originally, because when you're training a guide dog, puppy, you have to take her, have to take them everywhere. You have to go to the trainings every single week with the RSB. You have to take her into shopping centres, get her used to going up lifts, upstairs, escalators. The only places that I couldn't take her were the zoos and hospital. But everywhere, I took her on planes, like into the aircraft, and that was actually quite an experience. So I got the five-star treatment. And we, as you said, we took her to outside broadcast. I took her to the Jamestown Style Yards, took her to the Royal Adelaide Show. I think every single outside broadcast I took her, because that was the deal. You had to take them everywhere. She had to wear her coat. You had to give the impression that when she has her coat on, that's when she was working and she had to behave. Barley was very exuberant and I think very impatient. And she did a lot of sitting around and waiting, and you could tell it just wasn't her thing. She wanted to be out and enjoying life. So I was worried. I wasn't quite sure whether she was going to suit the guide dog life, but she was on track until I introduced her to the farm. And that's when things started to go a bit pear-shaped. But yeah, she was wonderful in that respect, and we did form the ABC Rural team, got to be a part of her life in some way, because they went and travelled to all the different ABC stations, and you all got to meet her. And she did the footy tipping with Joe Sullivan at the ABC Port Pirie studios. We used to throw bottles, and whatever bottle she caught, that was, and whatever team name was in that bottle, that was the team that was going to win that week. So she did the footy tipping as well. Oh, it was just fun. It was just a lot of fun.
Was there, when she wasn't selected as a guide dog, when she didn't quite pass her training, was there a little bit of inside where you thought, oh, this is good, I get to keep her?
Well, everyone said to me, Belle, we don't understand why you've done this, because how are you going to feel when you have to give her back, spending 2 years looking after a dog? And I always said, oh, no, this is for a good cause, I'll be fine. I know what I've got myself in for. It's totally fine. And, yeah, as it got closer and her exam was approaching, I was starting to get a bit anxious and sleepless nights and all that jazz. And I actually remember the exam that she did. We had to go for a walk with some of the RSB professional team, and she was on her worst behaviour. She wouldn't toilet on command. She wouldn't sit. She wouldn't do anything. It was like she was in a really bad mood. So that was it. She failed from that moment. And I said to the RSB, I said, I'm so sorry. I feel like I've let you down. Is there any other service that she could be a part of, like aged care or schools or something? And they said, no, she's not really fit for anything.
Poor Barley.
I know. I said, oh, okay. All right, so what does that mean? And they said, well, you can keep her at a price.
What was she like as a farm dog?
Oh, she loved it. She went to the farm every day. She helped Otto in the sheepyard. I don't really believe that she helped him, but she said she was there.
Yeah,
Labrador. I think the sheep thought she was a sheep because, I don't know, they just were very inquisitive of her. So, I don't know, she could have just been one of the sheep. She loved that life. She had so much freedom and she was a good dog. She never wandered. She stayed home when she was told. She never barked. She never, I don't know, we would just hit the jackpot with her. And when we had kids, she was very gentle and, I don't know, it's going to be hard to ever replace her, which I don't think I possibly could for a long time. But she was, she was wonderful.
And what are you going to be the best memories of Barley?
I think the early memories I'll always remember, she always used to chew the power cords in the office and used to give Drew apoplexy. And we always used to have someone come in having to change all the power cords. We used to travel to the Royal Adelaide Show in Drew's car, and Drew was very fastidious about his vehicle. And so because Labrador's molt, like you wouldn't believe, and she was a Labrador retriever, which seemed to be worse. He used to go and vacuum his car every single time that Barley came into his car. And I remember she used to rouse on you. So if you weren't, I'd come home some days and I'd get out of the car and she'd just sit there and she'd start talking to me and really rouse on me because I wasn't here or something's happened. She used to have these conversations with you and, it was just, she was just hilarious. She really spoke her mind when you'd done something wrong. So they're the memories that I had. But also the other one was when I went to Brisbane and I think most of the cabin crew thought I was visually impaired because I was on the plane first and they were watching me walk down the plank or the bridge to the plane and got to sit Barley down in the seat next to me on the floor. And they were coming up to me and talking to me quite close to my face. It's like, and I had to say to them, I'm sorry, but I'm actually a puppy educator and I'm educating this dog to be a guide dog. I'm actually not visually impaired. And they went, oh, my goodness, thank goodness for that, because we started to feel really sorry for you because your dog was all over the place.
So that's where it was first picked up, that maybe she might not have a life as a guide dog.
No, she was. I thought I was doing really well as a puppy educator, but obviously I really sucked at it.
She was obviously really well known as well. You still have, people in the street asking after Barley. I've had listeners asking how Barley has been going as well. So obviously she was very well known.
Yes, I can't get over that. People still come up to me and people I don't know saying, oh, you used to work for the ABC. How's the dog? I love that my lasting legacy at the ABC has got nothing to do with the content or any of the stories I did. It was all about Barley. I thought it was worth letting you all know that she has passed away and she passed away peacefully and at 13. And she's now buried in the backyard and the kids have made a cross and she lived a really good life.
That is former Country Hour presenter Annabelle Ottens, or we may remember her as Annabelle Homer, speaking with Brooke Neindorf about Barley, the failed guide dog who sadly has passed away at the age of 13. And just so you know, tomorrow is International Guide Dog Day, so it might be just the time to look at being a guide dog trainer. Speaking of guide dogs, Nikolai on Afternoons today has their guide dog in training, Coda. I mean, hopefully Coda is a bit more successful than Barley was at being a guide dog. But also keep tuning in to Nikolai's afternoon program after one to get any further updates on a bushfire that is burning at Malinong. So just a reminder, we have a watch and act alert for a bushfire that is burning at Malanong, which is 18 kilometres northeast of Meningi in the Coorong. The advice from the CFS is to leave now. The bushfire may threaten your safety. Check that the path is clear, of course, and go to a safer place. Do not enter that area. The conditions, we're told, are dangerous. That's a stubble fire burning mainly southeasterly towards Bagshaw Road and Malanong Road. However, conditions, we're told, are continually changing due to the wind change, which is now moving through the area. So just a reminder, you will have further updates on that fire with Nikolai in the afternoon's program. So keep listening to ABC Radio Adelaide. And, of course, you can go to the CFS website as well for further information. That's all about it for me for today. Thank you very much for your company. I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more South Australian Country Hour. Don't forget that you can catch up on anything you may have missed throughout the program. Just hop on the ABC Listen app. It's a free app. You can download it right now onto your smartphone or tablet if you don't have it. You can go to our website. Just look for South Australian Country Hour. And all of the latest rural news is available on abc.net.au/rural. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock and almost time for the news.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone, search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon, and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.